I have the peculiarity of having an interest in both mathematics and theology. I'm an ordained pastor as well as a teacher of mathematics. Sometimes people have asked me why and how I got involved in both of these areas, and I've sometimes jokingly said it's because as a boy I couldn't distinguish between the words angel and angle. And so I still have to look at those words to detect exactly which one I'm looking at. I wrote to Holden Village some years ago and expressed an interest in coming here because I knew that a lot of different things were done at Holden, and I thought perhaps there might be some place for a person who had an interest in these two areas to fit in. And I knew that many things that we speak of in mathematics, or perhaps most things, don't have any relation at all to theology. It seemed to me that something along the line of mathematical patterns in nature might be of interest to people who come to the village. And so with that in mind, I wrote to the people here, and they said, fine, come along, and that's how I happened to get on the staff here at Holden. I think that to many people, the coming to Holden is a kind of a return to nature experience, something in the nature of Thoreau's going back to nature at Walden Pond, and getting in contact with nature again. Most of us live lives that are very much isolated and or insulated from nature. We eat food that is canned and packaged. We don't see the original plant growing. We tend to receive most of the things that sustain us, but which derive from nature, after these things have passed through many hands. And it's a good, refreshing experience to come back to a place like Holden and to get close to nature again and to feel something of its life and pulsation. I think the Old Testament is full of references to man and nature, and all of you know that very well. You read the Psalms, and the psalmist is constantly alluding to the way in which nature speaks to him about God's activity. And in the book of Job, we hear again the references to place of nature in Job's life. And God asks Job, where were you when I laid the foundations of the world, and when the morning stars sang together? And we have this kind of mystery confronting Job and the psalmists and many other people in the Old Testament as they confronted nature. And I think we still feel much of that in our own coming back to a place like this to be among the things of nature and to reflect on them. You recall the figure of the cherubim. It includes the head of I think the lion and I don't recall the animals, but there are animal heads and there's a human head in the cherubim, again expressing this idea of the closeness that exists between man and nature. We have lost much of that, I think, and it seems to me that going back to the Old Testament reminds us of our closeness to nature. In the New Testament, Jesus often went away into the hills there to be by himself and in some kind of solitude to find refreshment. And Paul speaks about creation groaning and travailing, of course. One thing that intrigues me about nature is this mixture of understanding and mystery. Scientists seek to understand how the world is put together, how it functions, but we always confront new mysteries. They're always with us. Some time ago I read a statement that has continued to intrigue me. It says, the larger the island of knowledge, the longer the shoreline of mystery, and it seems that's the way in which we discover the world to be. we continue to expand and grow in our understanding of nature in a scientific or whatever sort of way, but the element of mystery remains and sometimes seems to become even more immense as we consider it. Now, we all look at nature in different ways. You might consider a tree, for example. If you are a lumberman, you'll look at it in one way. You'll see it as a product that can be used to make houses and all sorts of things. If you are a poet, you will see it in somewhat a different way. If you are a businessman or if you're a housewife, whatever your vocation is, will tend to influence the way in which you see the nature around you. Now, I spend much of my time in mathematics, and so one thing that intrigues me about nature is, are those things that have a kind of mathematical aspect about them. And the notion of symmetry is a very strong idea in mathematics. You'll find it appearing explicitly in the study of what we call groups. I don't want to go into mathematics this morning, but some of you may be familiar with the subject of abstract algebra and know that there the idea of groups are considered. It's a very significant body of mathematics. And many figures have certain symmetrical properties about them. And again, I don't want to belabor the point, but let me just take as an example a box. This is not a cube, but imagine it is a cube. It has obvious symmetries. First of all, there is a symmetry about certain planes. If you would cut the box cut the cube in half in this direction, the right half could be seen as a reflection of the left half. So that a vertical plane through here would be called a plane of symmetry. Likewise, a plane through here would be a plane of symmetry, and a plane through here would be a plane of symmetry. So that you'd have three planes of symmetry. That kind of symmetry is called a symmetry deriving from reflection. There's also a kind of symmetry deriving from an axis of a figure. So, for example, if you pass an axis through this face, so it comes out here, you can rotate the cube through 1, 2, 3, 4 positions. So it's an axis having a fourfold symmetry. There's one here, and one here. So we have three axes of this kind displaying a threefold symmetry. Now, you could also pass an axis through this edge and have it come out this edge of the cube and rotate the cube about that axis, and you would obtain you would have an axis displaying a threefold symmetry. If you play with the cube for a while, you'll recognize that. And there are four of those axes, one in this direction, one here, and one here. And then likewise, you could pass an axis through this corner, so it would come out this corner. And so you would have, you would have four of these with a threefold symmetry, and you would have six axes through midpoints of the sides displaying a twofold symmetry. So that you can very completely analyze the symmetry of a figure by looking at mathematical groups. Now, that's perhaps enough of mathematics. I don't want to pursue that matter further. But all of you have observed in nature, I'm sure, the kinds of symmetry that we find there. The Greeks made a great deal of this. They saw that the disk of the sun was a circle, and this was a beautifully symmetrical figure. In fact, any axis through a disk is an axis of symmetry. So that there is a kind of infinitude of axes of symmetry for the disk of the sun. And likewise, the figure of the pine tree, which is a kind of a triangular form. This likewise is a symmetrical figure with a vertical axis in it. If you drop an axis through the pine tree's central stem, you can rotate that pine tree around and have a kind of manifold symmetry about that axis as well. The Greeks felt that mathematics was very important in understanding of God, because to them, mathematics shared not only in the life of nature, they saw the mathematical forms in nature, the triangle, the circle, and many other figures, but in the mind these could be idealized. There is such a thing as a perfect circle. We cannot draw one, but it exists. And so to the Greeks, the world of mathematics was a kind of bridge between the world of nature and their deity. Now that's stretching things quite a bit for us. We don't elevate mathematics to that kind of a level. But at least we do, I think, feel the influence of the Greeks at this point. And much of the development of physics and chemistry has fallen under this influence. And we have sought to see in nature, in many ways, this kind of symmetrical structure. And we have looked for laws that display this kind of symmetry within them. Now, the symmetry we find in nature depends to a large extent upon two things. Upon the environment in which the object is found, and secondly, on its properties of locomotion, or how it moves along. If you take a very elemental form of life in the sea that does not have any particular locomotion properties about it, and simply tends to float or rest on the bottom of the sea, let's say, it will have a great deal of symmetry. So you take a sea urchin, for example, that is essentially round and has an infinite number of axes of symmetry about it. And any other object in the sea that would live like this, experiencing nearly equal forces of buoyancy and the pull of gravity, would tend to be developed in such a way as to have many planes of symmetry or many axes of symmetry about it. Now, once the element of locomotion comes into the picture, then part of this symmetry is destroyed. So, for example, in a fish, once he begins to take on motion, we have bilateral symmetry. That is that kind that exists or is displayed by passing a plane vertically through the fish. But otherwise, if you cut the fish somewhere between its head and its tail, there is found no plane of symmetry. Likewise, cutting it horizontally, no plane of symmetry again. And then if you go to the creatures on the land, there is still a greater loss of symmetry. But all of the creatures that move about on the land, or at least almost all of them, have what we call bilateral symmetry. That is the kind that we ourselves possess. If we pass a plane through ourselves, through our noses and down, we divide into two parts one being essentially a mirror image of the other. Now, the strongest expression of symmetry is found in the crystals. You are all familiar with the way in which substances can break up. If you take a piece of salt, of rock salt, and you crack it, it will tend to break up in planes that are perpendicular to one another. And this expresses its internal crystalline structure, a very rigid and very precise kind of structure as compared to many other forms we find in nature. But interestingly, in the crystals, we can find crystals that have axes of twofold symmetry, threefold symmetry, fourfold symmetry, and sixfold symmetry, no fivefold symmetry. You will never find a crystal such that if you pass an axis through it, you can rotate it through five positions, in each position it falling back upon itself again. That kind of situation will never occur. Snow crystals, on the other hand, always have a sixfold symmetry about them. If you take a snow crystal, rotate it through a sixth of a turn, two-sixths, three-sixths, and so on, it will always fall back upon itself. And this kind of perfect symmetry is characteristic of inanimate objects. And that was expressed to some extent in a story written by Thomas Mann called The Magic Mountain. One of the characters in that story is a fellow named Hans. He goes skiing in the morning, and the snow is beautiful and bright and glistening, and he's gliding down the hill, and everything is beautiful in his world. And in the afternoon, he gets caught in a snowstorm. And while he is in the snowstorm, the snow appears less beautiful to him. Suddenly, he's cold, and he is miserable, and he sees around him everywhere all of these snowflakes settling on him and on the earth. And he becomes somewhat terrified by this snow. It's an entirely different thing for him now. And he does survive the storm, but afterwards he reflects upon this sterility and the death that is found in this perfect symmetry of the snowflake. And he says he thinks he now understands why, when the ancient architects built buildings, they would often put into those designs some asymmetrical aspect. They would somehow throw off the perfect symmetry and thereby avoid this kind of staticness that goes with the perfect symmetry of the snowflake. Maybe there's something of that expressed too in the poem Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright in the Forests in the Night. What immortal hand or eye dare shape thy fearful symmetry? Though there a living thing is being spoken about. But nonetheless, this kind of symmetry that is so perfect and so precise is not seen as very vital to us. Which points up another aspect of this symmetry. As I said, most things that are inanimate tend to have perfect symmetry found in them. But once we move from the inanimate into the animate, then there comes into the picture of kind of asymmetry or a lack of symmetry. And this is a very fascinating aspect of much of of modern physics and biology. And I'm not a physicist or a biologist, but the notions that arise here nonetheless are intriguing. We do expect to find a kind of symmetry in nature, I think, and at least we, well, take a picture, for example. If you have a photograph of a natural scene and you reverse that picture, suppose you put the slide in your projector backwards, you obtain another natural scene of nature, but there's nothing surprising about it. It's a perfectly acceptable picture. And unless someone has been to that place, they will not see anything unusual about this picture. It will appear to them to be a perfectly ordinary and a natural scene. But if you inject into that picture something that is man-made, often that will be the clue to which is the true scene and which is the reversed image of it. I have at home a photograph that I took in the Tetons showing the cathedral group. Some of you may be familiar with the mountains there. And there's no way to tell whether that picture is has been reversed or not unless you seek out a small road sign that's hidden almost behind a tree. And that sign says speed 10 miles per hour. And this is the clue to the proper orientation of the things in the picture. A few weeks back, I was at services in my home church, and the bulletin for that Sunday showed a scene of a farmer on a tractor pulling a plow down the field. And the plow happened to be throwing the soil not to the right, but to the left. Now, any farmer knows that most plows, at least, throw the soil to the right instead of to the left. And so someone observed that the person who put together that church bulletin did not know the ins and outs of farming, because otherwise he would have reversed the picture. So it's often the human and man-made elements in the picture that give us a clue as to which is the right way to put the slide into the projector. Now, I mentioned that there is a strong urge, I think, within us toward a kind of symmetry in nature. But first let me say something about some asymmetrical aspects of that we find in nature, and these, of course, among living things. This hand of mine by itself is not symmetrical. But if I put my thumb against a mirror, I would obtain this hand. So that we call these enthiomorphic figures, because one is a mirror image of the other one. And sometimes we will find in nature this particular kind of figure without the other one appearing. And this has tended to puzzle physicists and biologists at many different levels. Some examples of these kinds of asymmetrical figures are found in the spiral of the nebula. These are called logarithmic spirals, by the way. And that spiral is exactly the same one you find in the ram's horn, or in the tooth of a tiger, or in the claw of a cat. It's the same one you find in the chambered nautilus, in mollusks. All of these have, or pattern themselves very much after what we call the logarithmic spiral. And all of them take this form because they derive out of the growth process. And that imposes upon them a certain kind of turn in their growth pattern. Another interesting figure we find in nature is is the helix, which is not symmetrical. Now, the spiral staircase is a helix. A number of plants, climbing plants, have on them tendrils. And these, for the most part, are right-turning spirals. But there are some other plants that have left-turning tendrils. So, for example, the honeysuckle has tendrils that turn counterclockwise or to the left. And the morning glory has tendrils that twist to the right. Now, if you get two morning glory plants together, you can separate them. Or two honeysuckles together, you can separate them. But you get a morning glory and a honeysuckle together, and you will have a terrible time pulling them apart. Because you've got the right-handed corkscrew and the left-handed corkscrew intertwining, and they will be almost inextricable from one another. There are some lines in literature that refer to this peculiarity. So Ben Jonson, in Vision of Delight, says, "The blue bindweed doth itself enfold with honeysuckle." And Shakespeare, in A Midsummer Night's Dream, the characters there are Queen Titania and Bottom the Weaver. And Shakespeare says of them, "Sleep thou, and I will wind thee in my arms. So doth the woodbine the sweet honeysuckle gently entwist." These authors use the figures of these two kinds of plants to express the embrace of the lovers here. Some of you may know the name of Joseph Wood Crutch, who died, perhaps 6-7 years ago, but was a very well-known U.S. naturalist and writer. He went to the Carlsbad Caverns and watched the bats coming out of the caverns in the morning, in the evenings. And they always spiraled in a clockwise direction as they left the cavern. Always in a clockwise direction. So he asked himself if the same would be true in the southern hemisphere, but he never had a chance to research it. And the umbilical cord on a child always has a clockwise twist to it. Again, an asymmetrical phenomenon. Now, as I said, there was a strong drive among physicists to find or to establish a kind of symmetry. So where you find this kind of a figure, that is something asymmetrical, there is always the curious question, does the counterpart exist, the mirror image? And is there a preference in nature for right-handedness or left-handedness? All of you have heard, I'm sure, about the notions of the left-handed universe and the right-handed universe and such things, which are questions I don't have the competence to deal with adequately, but they do nonetheless derive partly out of this question of symmetry in nature. We do give a preference in our language to right-handedness and in our actions. We shake hands by using the right hand. Most of us write with our right hands. And also in our manner of speech. The word right, which stands for either right hand or for correctness or law abiding, suggests that we give preference to right. In the Latin language, we have the words dextral and sinistral. Dextral meaning right, and sinistral meaning left. And from that word, we get the notion of sinister. The right and left hand of God, again, the left hand being judgment and the right hand being more benevolent and gracious. So in our language, we find this kind of preference for right. When Pasteur was doing his experiments, he uncovered an acid that had some peculiar characteristics about it. He took the salt crystals that derived from this acid and found that they were not all alike, but that some of these crystals were mirror images of the others. See, just like my left hand is a mirror image of the right hand. So he sorted out the crystals into right and left-handed kinds of crystals, and he found that the one set of crystals would twist a ray of polarized light to the right, and the other crystals would twist the polarized ray of light to the left, and hence the right and left-handedness of these crystals was demonstrated. And then he found out also that while the one kind of crystal was associated with an acid that is commonly found in the brewing process, the acid relating to the other kind of crystal was not, at his time, even known. So this, in a sense, gave some impetus to scientists to ask the question, when they found the one kind of crystal, does the other one exist, and can we construct it? And out of that have come a number of new kinds of compounds that hitherto had not been known. There might be among you a number of chemists, or some chemists at least, who could elaborate on this better than I could. But this right and left-handedness of molecules has been studied quite extensively. And that, too, has been anticipated or suggested in literature. W.H. Auden, for example, has a poem in which he speaks of a man sitting at a bar with a glass of liquor in his hand. And he asks his image in the mirror if his liquor tastes the same as that which is in his own glass. And in Alice in Wonderland, Alice talks to her cat and contemplates whether the milk the cat drinks once they've passed through the mirror will taste the same to the cat as the milk that the cat now drinks. And though these are somewhat whimsical questions in these poems and in the Alice in Wonderland, they are significant questions in the field of chemistry and biology. We have different kinds of sugars. Dextrose, for example, is a kind of sugar, grape sugar, that displays this right-handedness. Dextrose right-handedness, as a polarized light is passed through the compound, the rays are twisted to the right. And fruit sugar, fructose, on the other hand, is a left-handed kind of sugar. And they don't taste the same. They don't taste the same. So there are compounds which have exactly the same number of atoms and molecules in them, but they are put together differently, one being a mirror image of the other, and that can influence the taste of these particular compounds. Tobacco is essentially left-handed. Maybe right-handed cigarettes would be less harmful than left-handed. And in line with W.H. Auden's reflections on liquor, again, the one of the components of liquor is, as I recall, predominantly left-handed. So you do find this aspect of it. Well, I don't want to go further with this, but as you go out on the trail and look around, as you look at rocks and stones, you might be alert to some of the patterns of symmetry and some of the mathematical figures that you can see in them. And if you, when you get home, you might reflect a little more or consider some of these other mysteries and peculiarities we find in nature around us. So now, any comments or if any of you are involved in chemistry and physics, I'm sure you could add significantly to some of these things. Yes, I think so. Yeah, I would agree. Again, the perfect symmetry is related so much to inanimate objects. When the Greeks wrote about symmetry, they did not mean a strict mathematical symmetry. To them, it was harmony. And so they could speak about a human figure that was not necessarily, taking a balanced pose, but instead had some graceful expression about it as being symmetrical, because it had a pleasing appearance about it.
Explain a little bit about the Fibonacci series. How is that what explains this growth curve, like on the Rand Horn and Supernova?
Yes, they're tied together. You're familiar with the golden rectangle, perhaps. I need a blackboard to do this. Well, this is very close to being a golden rectangle, the top of this box. In fact, many of the rectangular forms we find in design are golden rectangles. This idea is very, very old. It goes back to the Greeks. They called a rectangle a golden rectangle if it had the following property. Suppose you take this side and lay it off along the longer side here. Then you obtain a square. And there remains then another rectangle. If that rectangle has the same proportions as the initial rectangle, then we have a golden rectangle. In other words, you could continue this process. You could take a square out of the remaining rectangle here and obtain a new rectangle at the top with the same proportions as this rectangle and the initial one. And the process can be continued ad infinitum. Continue that indefinitely. Now, if you would take, let's say, the midpoint of this particular, lay off this length along this edge and choose the midpoint, or for that matter, any point. Find the corresponding point in this rectangle and in this rectangle and so on, then you can construct a kind of a spiral. If I had a blackboard, I could demonstrate that more clearly. But nonetheless, you do obtain a spiral, and that is precisely the spiral that we find in the galaxies and the ram's horn and all such. Well, this proportion, the proportions of this rectangle derive from the Fibonacci numbers. Fibonacci numbers are 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, so on, where you get the next one by adding the previous two. So you start with 1 and 1, that gives you 2, add 1 and 2, you get 3, add 2 and 3 and get 5, add 3 and 5 and get 8, so on down the line. Now, if you take ratios of these, that is 1 over 2, 2 over 3, 3 over 5, 5 over 8, so on, and then inquire about the limit of that sequence of ratios, then that limit turns out to be the ratio between these two sides. So that's where the Fibonacci numbers come in. Fibonacci was an Italian who lived about 1130 or 40, I believe. Leonardo Pisa is often the name given to him. Fibonacci means son of a bumpkin or bungler. His father was was regarded as a village fool, and so Fibonacci, son of bungler, was the name given to him. He studied for quite some time in North Africa, and there came in contact with the Arabs, and at that time the Arabs were the custodians of algebra. And the Arabs, in turn, had gotten from the Egyptians a particular number, 11235, and so on. And he brought this back home and puzzled over it and finally sorted out the sequence from it. And then these other relationships have been observed later. But they relate to many things in nature. The arrangement of leaves on a stem, the number of spirals around the, take a pine cone, and there you can count spirals going to the right and to the left. The number of these spirals will always be a Fibonacci number. Sunflower seeds, the pineapple always has three spirals, two in one direction, one in the other direction, and these are always Fibonacci numbers, so on. Now, it's mind-boggling, but out of this very strong drive for that leads to the search for counterparts to these various elements, many, many theories have arisen about the entire universe. And so now, you can find literature speaking about universes and anti-universes, for example. If there is in existence this universe consisting of predominantly, let's say, one kind of matter, then there must be another universe made up of antimatter. And a number of elements in physics have come into being because of this search. So the positron and the electron, for example, are... the positron is a result of a search initiated by the electron. You know, the electron seemed to be a kind of a loner. Though Fritz Norstadt said the other day that he has a friend who has a medical doctor who has been dealing with epilepsy. And in very extreme cases, surgery has been performed upon people and the entire half of the brain removed. And the remaining half begins with training to take over the other functions. Yes, uh-huh. Yes, I don't know how that developed. Some of you may be more... Yes, yeah.
Some theories that we deposit stimuli, as it were, throughout the brain, in all cells, which suggests that you could recover. And yet, you know, when you got separated brains as a consequence of surgery, that what the right hand can do, the left eye, you can't do them, you block the right and the left eyes, they can't repeat the processes they learn. So you can feel something with the left hand, for example, or the right hand, whichever, but you can't name it.
I see. Oh.
There's a lot of things in nature that point to a circle, and isn't a circle is a symbol of infinity, and it sort of implies that really down to thinking about how we got here and religion and everything, you've got to come to some conclusion that there is no beginning and no end, and that in itself is a circle. So a circle is the thing that's where without a beginning or end.
This is often used as a symbol for expressing that that notion.
Sometimes they emphasize balance. know, the painters, for instance, painted a lot of figures on one side and then put something on the other side. It wasn't necessarily the same thing, but there was the idea of centers of interest.
So if you have a small, or if you have a large, heavy, or large, dark figure on one side, the picture will seem unbalanced.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you keep the dark area small and the...
I'm not an artist, but I know that in art, appreciation is the kind of thing you stress. That the artist did feel that there had to be some kind of arrangement so that the two sides would be satisfied.
Mm-hmm. Well, if any other observations or...
I think that the symmetry that you find now, as opposed to balance, is much more an impact engineer than an artist.
Is it?
I think so. Because some Austrian did this study about 78 years ago. It went back to look at the old plazas in famous cities and through maps of them. And they were very unsymmetrical.
Yes, I know.
And you took a map, for example, of the Acropolis, and it probably, if the engineer would have drawn that as a map, it probably would have flunked them because it was terribly unsymmetrical. The lines didn't line up properly, and you know, the usual pattern that we have has come out of actually making plans. Well, of course, they didn't make plans. They just kind of drifted over quite a bit. So I think it reflected much more the balance than you were saying.
Yeah, well, I learned is that it had to be symmetrical to the eye, but it wasn't symmetrical. I mean, the same thing is true of the Parthenon. That those buildings were symmetrical to the eye, although they were not symmetrical.
The whole plaza
was
symmetrical. So, I think symmetry may be part of the balance.
Well, I think it's a feeling of satisfaction.
Yes.
That things aren't sort of top heavy or unpleasing or something like that. That's the thing.
And maybe symmetry is the simplest way of trying to do that, whereas artists, I think, are more sophisticated in their concept of balance than engineers are. And so therefore they tend to get more pleasing ways of balancing rather than just making the left side the same as the right side.
What about the newer architecture, though? Don't they do some of this, I think? Some of the newer buildings don't look very symmetrical always, I don't think. I mean, the ones that are done like some of the, not the skyscraper type, but the, you know, the smaller, more artistic buildings.
I think during the Middle Ages, the cathedrals tended to be symmetrical in their structure, though they were built over such long periods of time that sometimes you have a kind of a historical asymmetry coming into them because one generation began them and another generation finished them. And the later generation didn't have the same ideas that the first one did. And so you have sometimes towers that aren't identical, for example. But basically, the structure was symmetrical. But then, theology has changed since then, too. And in those days, there was quite a stress upon the justice of God, and and justice, of course, suggests a kind of evenness and fairness and balance. But today there's, I think, a little different understanding of theology. And that no longer is a dominant theme. Interrelatedness and a more general aesthetic harmony is sought rather than this kind of rigorous balance. So modern churches often are asymmetrical in design. You'll have the altar set off to one side and the roof of the building may have a longer slope on one side than on the other, expressing really more of what nature is like, because as we mentioned earlier, the living aspect of nature is essentially asymmetrical in its character.
I'm wondering about some cultural differences. Some say that we have grown up in a carpenter's world, which means, obviously, that we got straight pictures on the wall, and this or else we're uncomfortable. And yet, what about cultures where they have not had a carpenter's world, like some native groups? which raises a question, is there an inevitability, because of what you said, given the opportunity and the technology, that man ultimately would live in a carpenter's world?
Well, I wouldn't say it's inevitable.
But some of the issues in the discussion about what you say scientifically can be proved mathematically, this is fundamental in structure, that is symmetry.
Talking about absolute, referring to the being symmetry or there not being symmetry. If you look at a building or a closet, you're talking about you applying symmetry in small sections. Symmetry in the toilet. And I think even in the building, where you're talking about the wall being off one side, walls going in different directions, you would still find basic rectangular, circular, and other symmetrical shapes used.
And it's the mixture of the two that makes it interesting.
It would be the same thing as having all of your food sweet, all of the salt, get very tired of all the concept. So you need this balance or this mixture that you find interesting and amazing.
I think, I don't know, maybe it goes back to the Greeks' approach to things again, because there has been this very strong drive in Western physics to find these counterparts. And this search has led to a number of new discoveries. And so the success that has been met by following this pattern, I think, urges physicists to continue in this direction to some extent. They continue finding these new particles that are counterparts of known particles. But I don't know the Oriental mind, maybe. without this influence of Greek culture, there wouldn't be this. Yes?
Maybe that's what it meant by
I think order is a part of understanding. I think that we continually seek for order in things and relatedness. And that is basic. If we're going to understand how this world we live in, we must at some point bring in the notion of order.
And that would be the heartbeat.
Yeah. But there are many kinds of orders, too. There are, just as there is a slow heartbeat and a fast heartbeat, we find in nature many rhythms that are of different frequencies. You find the flutter of the butterfly's wing, and then you find the pulsation of giant stars, you know, that is exceedingly slow, and the world is a mixture of all of these different things. And their intermixing with one another produces various aberrations that complicate the understanding of nature, I think. Yes. Yes. I think we need those elements of stability in our lives. before we can cope with the instability. We need the, perhaps we need a certain kind of basic symmetry in our life, if I can use the word, before we can cope with the many changes and fluctuations that we all encounter. A person can't become a good, artists, for example, are often accused of breaking the laws of art, but they understand the laws of art. You have to understand them first before you can break them effectively and do it well. And so there has to be within the artist this basic stability, I think, before he can move outside of the ordinary bounds of his discipline and do those things that are somewhat reactionary. Well, thank you very much. It's been fun talking with you.